Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We are going to start off in the Hollywood section. We've got some movies to talk about, some celebrities to check up on, and then it's business and politics. Our first headline, Hard Truths. The Michael Jackson movie's $200 million haul proves no man has ever been truly canceled. Why have so many men accused of sexual misconduct mounted comebacks in 2026? The answer is simple. People just don't care enough to stop them. This is by Hilary Boussis on April 26th. First, let's establish two things. One, Michael, the biopic, sanctioned by the Michael Jackson estate that opened Friday, is almost certain to make an enormous amount of money. The movie's currently on track for a $100 million opening in North America alone and could make $200 million or more internationally. And that's just in its first weekend. These aren't thriller numbers, but they're certainly healthy, particularly in the wake of several recent movies about musicians that crashed and burned, both critically and commercially. Two, before the film went into production, at least five boys, now men, had credibly and publicly accused Jackson of sexually abusing them when they were between the ages of 7 and 12. Five more people, four men and one woman, all siblings, came forward with similar claims on April 24th, 2026. How can all of these things be true at the same time? Filmmaker Dan Reed has a simple explanation. People don't care that he was a child molester, he told The Hollywood Reporter this week. Literally, people just don't care. And he's right. Reed's 2019 documentary, Leaving Neverland, a four-hour accounting of the allegations against Jackson, is excruciatingly detailed and powerfully compelling. It's difficult, if not impossible, to come away from the film without being convinced that Reed's subjects, Jackson accusers Wade Robson and James Safichuk, are telling the truth. Jackson, who died in 2009, denied all claims of sexual misconduct when he was alive. He was criminally charged with abusing a child, but acquitted after a trial in 2005. 7 years ago, in a fugue of Me Too-era righteousness, I edited Vanity Fair's laudatory review of Reed's film and gave our piece a headline that now seems painfully naive. Leaving Neverland may do what no other Michael Jackson exposé could. It didn't. As THR points out, Jackson might be more popular today than he was in the period before Leaving Neverland was released, when the allegations and the strange facts of the musician's final years, the Martin Bashir interview, the dangled baby, were fresher in the public memory. The Broadway musical MJ, which, like Michael, conveniently covers only the period before the first Jackson accuser came forward in 1993, has grossed nearly $330 million since it began previews in 2021. 2 years ago, according to a Jackson superfan on Reddit, the artist surpassed 50 million monthly listeners on Spotify for the first time. His monthly listener count has climbed by nearly 20 million, and that's without the bump of that off the wall and bad we'll likely get from Michael's release. Leaving Neverland, meanwhile, has vanished from the internet. 2 years ago, the Jackson estate successfully pushed HBO to remove the project from its streaming platform. In March of last year, Reed released a sequel on YouTube, but the original still can't legally be viewed in the United States. What conclusions can we draw from all this besides the obvious, that convincing, heart-wrenching testimony can't move the needle if a critical mass is determined not to let it? That there is no alleged crime or scandal serious enough to turn fans against any artist that they love, particularly if that artist has deep pockets and powerful lairs. That despite all the hand-wringing and think pieces and endless, endless complaints on social media about frothing mobs yearning to draw famous blood, there really isn't anything such as being canceled, at least not for those who are sufficiently beloved or connected. There was a moment, almost 9 years and one lifetime ago, when it seemed like things were really going to change. On October 5th, 2017, the New York Times reported that Harvey Weinstein had spent decades paying off women he had sexually harassed. Within weeks, the floodgates opened. Headlines popped up like mushrooms after a storm, alleging misconduct by one well-known name after another. Kevin Spacey, who has denied the allegations against him, was removed from a movie he'd already finished filming and replaced with another actor. In a heretofore unprecedented act, Oscar nominee Morgan Spurlock canceled himself. The tide, it seemed, was turning. Behavior that had long been tolerated, if not encouraged, would no longer be accepted. Time was up. Until it wasn't. Practically, as soon as the Me Too movement began, it was accused of going too far, sweeping up innocence in its wake, failing to allow its targets due process, because the burden of proof required to secure a conviction must also be met by every single person outside a courtroom, in every circumstance, forever and ever. Amen. Sure, some men were forced to resign or went to prison, but many weren't or didn't. And the most powerful among them, particularly those who didn't face actual criminal charges, managed to put their head down, console themselves with their enormous bank account, and gradually reemerge into public life as though nothing had happened. Which brings us to Michael and the melee that surrounds it. The last half decade has been lousy with post-cancellation comebacks, and this year seems to be the biggest one for them yet. Johnny Depp, whose ex-wife Amber Heard has accused him of assault, hasn't made a major studio movie since 2018, but he has one out in November called Ebenezer, A Christmas Carol, set to be released by Paramount. In May, Louis C.K. will headline a show at the Hollywood Bowl for the Netflix is a Joke Festival. John Lasseter, who was hired by David Ellison not long after being ousted from Pixar, produced Oscar winner Brad Bird's upcoming animated feature, Ray Gunn. Woody Allen has secured financing for his next movie. Actors like Scarlett Johansson and Javier Bardem have publicly reiterated their support for him. In certain circles, Jeffrey Epstein has been reborn as a style icon. Brett Ratner is earning healthy paychecks for directing state-sanctioned Trump family propaganda, and a fourth Rush Hour movie allegedly requested personally by the president himself. Speaking of, Donald Trump is president again, like right now. Louis C.K. admitted to sexually harassing women in 2017. All other accused men in this paragraph and the one above have denied wrongdoing and the allegations against them. In 2022, Depp and Heard both won compensatory damages after filing competing defamation lawsuits. Even Weinstein, who was convicted of rape in New York in 2020 and found guilty on three sex crime charges in Los Angeles in 2022, may yet found have a second act. The verdict of his first New York trial was overturned in 2024, leading to a new trial in 2025, which resulted in a conviction on one charge, an acquittal on a second charge, and a hung jury on another charge, and a third trial that began this week. "I won't apologize for something I didn't do. I will be proven innocent, that I promise you," the former mogul, who has long denied any wrongdoing, told THR just last month. "I won the last appeal. I'll win this one, too." He has reason to be optimistic. Bill Cosby, the alleged predator most often mentioned in the same breath as Weinstein, saw his own sexual assault conviction overturned in 2021. Cosby's plans for a 2023 comedy tour didn't come to fruition, but maybe that's only because he was waiting for the great wave of 26. The large-scale return of the supposedly canceled can't be blamed on collective amnesia or even a public that clings to plausible deniability. Nor are the masses grappling with cognitive dissonance as they try to separate art from the artist. There seems to be very little guilt at play. Instead, Occam's razor suggests that the people in charge and civilians alike know that these men know what these men have allegedly done, and they just do not care. They look at Michael Jackson and, like Dave Chappelle in an old sketch, they shrug, he made Thriller. Thriller! By the way, despite what he may have told you, Chappelle has never actually been canceled either. He's released a special on Netflix every other year since 2017, including and since the one in which he made the transphobic jokes that inspired a company-wide staff walkout in 2021. This outcome has clearly frustrated Dan Reed, but he has stopped short of condemning it. "I'm not trying to stop anyone from consuming his music. I've never advocated canceling Michael Jackson. Book burning is for the Middle Ages and the Taliban," he said in the THR interview. "I just think if you're going to enjoy his music, let's also consider the fact that he liked to have sex with children and see how that affects your enjoyment. What recourse is there for those who do care, other than resigned acceptance and a bit of gallows humor?" Our next headline, Nick Reiner and the Making of a Modern Hollywood Tragedy, a courtroom dispatch. Reiner has pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder in the deaths of his parents, Rob and Michelle. In the same courthouse where O.J. Simpson stood trial for murder, Reiner's case is already drawing cameras, if not yet, answers. This is by Maxwell Adler on April 29th. The television crews started gathering outside the courthouse not long after sunrise, cameramen in cargo shorts and primped anchors drawn by the gravitational pull of tragedy. The air carried the weight of anticipation. When will Nick Reiner stand trial for the murder of his parents? Will he enter an insanity plea? Will his family members show up? It's been decades since this city has watched a courtroom with such fixation, since a white Bronco and a freeway chase turned legal proceedings into a televised ritual during the O.J. Simpson trial. Now, with the case of Reiner, the machinery hums again. Reiner appears in court for a hearing on the ninth floor of Clara Shortbridge Foltz Criminal Justice Center in downtown L.A., a couple dozen feet from the courtroom where Simpson stood trial in 1995. Reiner, 32, has been charged with two counts of first-degree murder in connection to the deaths of his parents, Rob and Michelle Reiner, who were found with fatal stab wounds in their Brentwood, California home on December 14, 2025. Reiner, who struggled with drug addiction and mental illness for most of his life, has pleaded not guilty. Today was the first time Reiner appeared in court since he entered his not guilty plea on February 23rd. But today was not a day for verdicts or vindication. Judge Sam Ota set a preliminary hearing date for September 15th. Reiner's public defender, Kimberly Green, said they're still waiting to receive nearly 2 terabytes of evidence from the prosecutors, including reports detailing the autopsies of Rob and Michelle Reiner. Green's comments implied a bit of tension between the prosecutors and the defense. Reiner's original defense team, led by defense attorney Alan Jackson, left the case in January following speculation that the defendant's family cut off their financial support. Roughly a week after signing onto the case, Jackson told the judge that he had no choice but to withdraw and asked to be relieved. Reiner appeared wearing a yellow prison jumpsuit top and blue pants. He only spoke one word, yes, when the judge asked him if he understood what was happening. The entire hearing lasted about 5 minutes. None of his immediate family was in the courtroom on Tuesday. His brother Jake wrote a Substack essay last week where he discussed how his life has been turned upside down by the alleged murders. Sure, any loss of a parent is devastating, but nothing compares to losing both of them at the same time, and on top of that, having your brother be at the center of it. It's almost too impossible to process, Jake wrote. The Reiners were deeply influential in the film industry and their community in Los Angeles. Rob Reiner rose to fame playing Michael Meathead Stivic on All in the Family. His career then moved seamlessly from comedy to drama, directing films like When Harry Met Sally, This is Spinal Tap, and Misery, while later appearing on screen in projects including The Wolf of Wall Street. Beyond Hollywood, he became an outspoken political figure in California, backing liberal causes, ballot initiatives, and Democratic candidates. His wife, Michelle Reiner, was also engaged in philanthropy. The couple had a long list of friends in Los Angeles, including Billy Crystal and Larry David, who were both reportedly seen at the Reiners' Brentwood home after the news of their deaths had been broken. In the days after the murders, Albert Brooks, who had known Rob Reiner since the two were teenagers, called him my oldest friend, adding that he was still in that not believing it stage. The defendant faces a maximum sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole or the death penalty. However, prosecutors have not yet signaled that they would pursue capital punishment. Reiner sat mostly expressionless in the courtroom, his eyes wide open and bulging. Nothing in Wednesday's brief hearing hinted at whether Reiner's lawyer would factor his mental health and substance abuse issues into the defense, though such a strategy is widely expected to emerge as the case moves forward. With a preliminary hearing now set for September, the case will move to a more consequential phase. Among those expected to be called to testify at some point are attendees of a Christmas party hosted by Conan O'Brien, which was attended by Rob, Nick, and Michelle Reiner hours before the murders, raising the prospect of celebrity witnesses entering the courtroom. It's unclear whether, like the Simpson case, the Reiner trial will be televised, but it's sure to pique the public's morbid curiosity. Next up in the Hollywood section, AI officially can't win an Oscar for acting or screenwriting. The Academy's new rules state that scripts must be human-authored to be eligible, and acting nominations must be demonstrably performed by humans with their consent. This is by Rebecca Ford on May 1st. Every year, the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Sciences announces new rules for the upcoming season, and this year, much of the focus is on AI. The Academy clarified rules for the two categories related to AI. In the acting categories, only roles that are demonstrably performed by humans with their consent will be considered eligible. And in the screenplay categories, the rules codify that screenplays must be human-authored to be eligible. AI has become a hot-button issue in Hollywood, especially after the marketing ploy of Tilly Norwood, an AI-generated actor, made performers especially nervous. Though there have not been any feature films with AI-generated stars, the Academy often looks ahead to what may be coming down the road when adjusting the rules. The Academy also added language that allows the organization to request more information about how AI was applied and human authorship in any project that uses generative AI. The most notable other rule change is to the International Feature Film category. Traditionally, each country can select just one film as its country's submission for this category. This led to some very acclaimed films not being submitted because the country chose another film. A recent example of this would be when France selected Tran Anh Hung's The Taste of Things over Justine Triet's Anatomy of a Fall. The latter had much more acclaim and had won the Palme d'Or at Cannes earlier this year, so it was a shock to see France snub it. Anatomy of a Fall went on to win the Oscar for Best Screenplay. For the 99th Oscars and beyond, countries can still submit in that same fashion, but additional films can be submitted for consideration by winning a qualifying award at an international film festival. Those festivals include the Berlin International Film Festival, Golden Bear for Best Film, Busan International Film Festival, Busan Award Best Film, Cannes Film Festival, Palme d'Or, Sundance Film Festival, the World Cinema Grand Jury Prize, Toronto International Film Festival gives the Platform Award, and the Venice International Film Festival gives the Golden Lion. Also for these films, the film will be credited as the nominee rather than the country or the region. The award will be accepted by the director, and the director's name will be listed on the statuette plaque after the film title, and if applicable, the country or region. It's a significant change for Oscar-seeking directors. While the director has usually been the person to accept the award for this category, this shift solidifies them as an Oscar winner, along with the country. Films from directors Bong Joon-ho, Asghar Farhadi, Paul Pawlikowski, Alfonso Cuarón, Jonathan Glazer, and Joachim Trier have all previously won the International Feature Film category. But, for example, while Trier accepted the award earlier this year for sentimental value, he is not technically the winner of an Oscar yet. For whoever wins next, they'll not only hold the trophy but also take home the title of Oscar winner. Our next story, Trinidad Chambliss is making millions playing college football. The NCAA wants to stop him. The 23-year-old star quarterback talks to Vanity Fair about his landmark legal case, his coaches past and present, and his upcoming season at Ole Miss. This is by Romani Jones on April 29th. On a Saturday morning in March, college senior Trinidad Chambliss arrives at the Olivia and Archie Manning Athletics Performing Center at the University of Mississippi in his black Jeep Grand Cherokee for an interview arranged by his agent. 5 years ago, his car would have warranted an NCAA investigation, and his agent, just the fact of having one, would have immediately ended Chambliss's college career. Now the most shocking thing is that his vehicle is so modest, and that rather than enter the NFL draft, he's headed into his sixth year of college. He'll make more money for the upcoming season than he would have 2 years as a late second-round pick, where experts projected his selection in this year's draft would be. "I have a financial advisor, I have an agent, I have a marketing agency," Chambliss tells me on Saturday, still trying to believe in himself. When he started college, Chambliss recalls, "It was, okay, I have $100 to spend on my groceries for these 2 weeks. It's just wild to see, like, the first check hit, and it's like, wow, I have that much money. That's crazy." Athletics are changing at a breakneck pace. The nexus of college football's past, present, and future is embodied in this young man from Grand Rapids, Michigan. His journey recalls the charm of days gone by where the love of the game was its glue. The present is reflected in his decision to leave one small school for another's bigger stage and deeper pockets. And his future, a raging battle between the state courts and the NCAA, will be a bellwether for all college sports. A highlight reel of big money in college athletics. In 2021, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled the NCAA's restriction on education-related benefits violated antitrust law, striking down the notion of amateurism, which the NCAA had used to justify banning player pay. And so, players were allowed to profit from the rights to their name, image, and likeness, NIL. A separate 2025 case paved the way for athletes to enter revenue-sharing deals with their schools. Add to this the NCAA transfer portal, which effectively allows athletes and coaches to swipe right. Enter college athletes who want to stay in school and play for longer. Walter Byers, the architect of the NCAA, once compared the thing he helped build to a plantation, but now the body has lost its control over athletes and their money, and it's treating Chambliss's case as a last stand. The NCAA's entire business model is illegal and unenforceable, says Andrew Cooper, executive director of United College Athletes Association, a nonprofit players group. So what the NCAA is trying to do, for whatever reason, is waste lots of resources to drag this out for as long as possible. An NCAA spokesperson tells Vanity Fair, "The vast majority of legal challenges to the NCAA's eligibility rules have failed, and these attempts to undermine college sports eligibility rules are robbing high school athletes of the opportunity to compete and get a scholarship, a life-changing opportunity for many young people." The story of Trinidad Chambliss has the hallmarks of a sports cinema, an unassuming hero coming from an inauspicious beginning in search of a change. Chambliss played his senior year of high school 6 years ago in the fall of 2020. In peak pandemic times, even something as simple as working out was a challenge, so his coaches at Forest Hills Northern High School personally delivered weights to players' homes. Lockdown also made exposure hard to come by for players like Chambliss. Because of COVID, it really, really knocked everybody in his class, says Cheryl Chambliss, Trinidad's mother, referring to the athletes who graduated high school in those years. Especially for him, for a loop, because the recruiting was little to nothing. Chambliss was a talented multi-sport athlete, but undersized, even by Division II standards. He was always chasing weight, and chasing weight is not easy, says his dad, Trent, who basically trained Trinidad from birth. His name, by the way, has nothing to do with the country. His mother has told reporters that she would have named a girl Trinity and therefore named her son Trinidad. Around the town of Oxford, Mississippi, however, the flag of Trinidad and Tobago flies on dozens of homes for the local hero. In 2021, Chambliss arrived at Ferris State University, a Division II powerhouse an hour from Grand Rapids. His first year, he redshirted, meaning he joined the team but did not play, thereby retaining a season of eligibility. In 2022, Chambliss suffered from tonsillitis and sleep apnea. Both those years, Ferris won the national championship. When Chambliss finally hit the field in 2023 as the backup quarterback, the team went 8-3. In 2024, he was the starter but threw two interceptions in the opener. "I lost the game," Chambliss said, "and it was a huge game." He fought self-doubt, but the bounce back was immediate. Chambliss threw 10 touchdowns in the next four games. By the middle of the season, Ferris State coach Tony Annie said, you're saying he's the best player in Division II." The Bulldogs dominated the rest of their season, won another national championship, and Chambliss finished third in voting for the Harlan Hill Trophy, awarded to the best player in Division II football. His private quarterback coach, Steve Calhoun, leveled with the pupil. "After that national championship game that they won, I said, 'Hey, T, like, you've outgrown the Division II Ferris State level,'" he says. 4 months later, Chambliss committed to play at the University of Mississippi, known as Ole Miss. "I trusted the people at Ferris State. I trusted my community there. I trusted my teammates, and it was tough," he said. "But that was a very small window to bet on myself and provide for my family and for myself." His coach understood. "I love Trinidad, and I think he loves me," Annie says, "but millions of dollars is going to matter more than love." After Ole Miss's starting quarterback suffered an ankle injury in week two, Chambliss took the reins and thrived. And then at the very end of the 2025 season, after months of speculation in national sports media, Ole Miss head coach Lane Kiffin bailed for bitter rival LSU and a $91 million contract. The team was on the precipice of the college football playoff, a feat the school had not done since the format's inception in 2014. Kiffin was excoriated by fans and media for abandoning his team, but neither Chambliss nor his family begrudged the coach for leaving. "I don't know what it would have looked like," Chambliss said, "if they made the championship game." The task of winning it all fell to Pete Golding, who had been a defensive coordinator under Kiffin and staff in flux. Composed of some assistants who worked for both Ole Miss and LSU at certain points. As the new head coach, Golding felt his staff was capable, but when it came to the plan, "I don't think clear is the right word," he said. He saw no reason for Chambliss to take on any additional pressure. "A quarterback, by image, is going to be the leader," Golding said, "but I think the biggest thing for us is like, look, man, we don't need anybody to do anything they haven't done up to this point, right?" Chambliss responded with three excellent performances in the college football playoff, but it ended in a 31-27 loss to the University of Miami Hurricanes with 18 seconds left. What was more, Chambliss knew he may have played his last college football game. Because Chambliss had redshirted in 2021 and could not play the following year because of illness, 2023 was the first season as a player and 2025 his third. Under those circumstances, NCAA protocol is for a school to apply one more season of eligibility. Given Chambliss's documented illness, he, his family, and the compliance department at Mississippi expected his application to be approved. On January 9th this year, the day after the heartbreaker loss, his waiver request was denied. In December, even after leaving for LSU, Kiffin had called the Arkansas attorney Tom Mars about Chambliss's case. Mars thought, "Here's a guy with a mountain of medical records, a doctor who said he was incapacitated, and the NCAA said they're not going to look at it." Mars told Chambliss's agent Fletcher Smith that they would have to sue the NCAA. "There's all kinds of reasons they're not going to grant this waiver," Mars said, "none of which have to do with merits." To Vanity Fair, the NCAA says this characterization is false and that they provided significant information regarding the decision. In a widely released extensive statement, the NCAA said that Chambliss had failed to submit sufficient documentation of his illnesses while at Ferris and thereby didn't meet the criteria for an extension. Chambliss calls the situation ridiculous. Cheryl takes personal offense, as a mother, at the notion that it was anything other than what they've asserted. What people don't really realize is that when you have something like that, with the swelling of the glands and the tonsils and all that, people's had, you know, a tragedy occur in their sleep, Trent Chambliss says. They just want to look at maybe a broken bone or a limb or whatever, but if you're not well, you're not well. Chambliss appealed the NCAA's decision and sued the NCAA in Mississippi State Court, requesting an injunction that would allow him to play immediately, which he was granted, and in March, the Mississippi Supreme Court denied the NCAA's request to appeal the lower court's injunction. Mars, who is working with the Oxford attorney William Liston on the case, has a doozy of a theory. Eligibility agreements in college sports are between the NCAA and its member schools. Technically, Mississippi applied for Chambliss's waiver, but the NCAA is duty-bound to support its athletes. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are currently in the middle of an article from VanityFair.com about Trinidad Chambliss, a college football player making millions of dollars. Let's continue. "We know that because its mission statement says it exists to serve students," Mars says. Chambliss says he was damaged because they refused to follow their own rules. In 2026, those damages would be stadium size. In 2024, Bryce Underwood signed to play quarterback for Michigan reportedly for $3 million per season. Chambliss, armed with rare leverage after a spectacular 2025 season, scored a one-season salary far greater than that. Chambliss's case is setting up a blueprint for state-by-state litigation, Cooper says. The irony is unavoidable. To win in court, the organization must dispute its obligation to its athletes. But where the NCAA truly wants to win is in Congress, which has spent years and millions of dollars lobbying. Cooper says they're trying to delay the inevitable and hope that Congress miraculously grants them a blank check bailout through the SCORE Act, a bipartisan bill that would standardize NIL rules and, most importantly, deem athletes as non-employees. The bill has not been brought to the House floor for a vote. I think they used Chambliss as a pawn in this lobbying effort that seems to be their sole focus in life, Mars says. That's the only logical explanation I've been able to come up with. Everyone around Chambliss, including his lawyer, is certain he'll play this fall. I care about my win-loss record, Mars says. Chambliss has seemingly gone pro, but stayed in school. And the body that sold stories like Chambliss's for years, who swore compensating players would cheapen the game, is the only entity who wants his story to end. That's college sports in 2026. We're moving to the politics section now. DC's strange late night, the surreal scene at WHCD parties after the shooting. Oz Perlman was mentalizing President Trump when the commotion started, and soon the main event was canceled. Then a different kind of wild time began across Washington's hotspots, where an esprit de presse corps, some dancing, and plenty of tequila made for a very American juxtaposition of violence and gaiety. This is by Aidan McLaughlin on April 26th. In the basement of the Washington Hilton, mentalist Oz Perlman was performing what he thought was his first trick of the night on President Donald Trump. It was a few minutes into the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and the room was halfway through the salad course. Perlman was standing over Trump on the dais, writing on a small notepad as the President and First Lady Melania Trump looked on. He was about to rip the paper to reveal the name of White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt's unborn baby. He guessed correctly that the girl will be named Vivian when he heard commotion in the ballroom and looked up to see Secret Service officers running through the tables below. "I thought a bomb was about to go off," he told Vanity Fair on Sunday. Secret Service agents armed with long guns rushed the stage as Trump and Melania hit the floor. Perlman went down as well, and as he turned his body, he was face to face with Trump. He wondered if the president had been shot. He thought he looked remarkably composed. Trump was pulled up and rushed out of the basement of the same hotel where Ronald Reagan was shot and wounded in 1981, stumbling and falling before officers got him off the dais. After a period of debate and confusion, the White House Correspondents' Dinner was canceled. Across town at the Washington Institution Cafe Milano, the mood wasn't dampened. Whoever controlled the music was playing the hits Toxic, Kiss Me, Oops, I Did It Again, and Promiscuous, blasted over the speakers as diners drank espresso martinis and woofed down bowls of lobster linguine. Patrons hovered over D.C. super lawyer Heather Podesta's shoulder as she watched CNN's breaking news coverage on her phone. Franco Nucci, the restaurant's beloved proprietor, held court at his corner table, checking in on dinner attendees who'd managed to escape the Hilton. ABC News chief Washington correspondent Jonathan Carl joined his table and fielded calls reporting on the shooting over the din. Once guests at the main event were allowed to leave the Hilton, some reporters sprinted to the White House, where Trump was delivering a press conference, flanked by members of his cabinet. Everyone, both government officials and press, were still in black tie garb. A tuxedoed Trump used the opportunity to renew his calls for a White House ballroom, the construction of which judges have repeatedly blocked. Other journalists rushed back to their newsrooms to cover the breaking story. In DuPont Circle near the Hilton, an otherwise quiet night was disrupted by the scream of sirens and purr of helicopters. People in evening wear trudged down the street, most with a phone to their ear. The night carried a distinctly American blend of violence and gaiety. NBC News, MS Now, and Time magazine had lavish after-parties planned following the dinner, and after some anguished deliberations, all three decided that the shooting would not be the end of the evening. MS Now rebranded from a party to a space for friends and colleagues to be together. The beatboxer was canceled, but the DJ was not, nor was the tequila cart that shuttled up and down the long room. The staff manning the cart periodically struck the metal tops of the bottles of Classe Azul, a flourish that caused the few jumps among the more skittish attendees. At the Time party, guests waited in long lines outside. They looked for the streamer Clavicular, who was rumored to be in attendance, though a Time representative said he did not show up. The ambassadors and cabinet members that typically stock these events were absent, with the exception of Congressman Maxwell Frost, who attended both the Time and MS Now parties in sunglasses and a boxy tuxedo. Substack, which hosted a party during the dinner, was locked down by security after letting in a few dozen guests. One White House reporter complained that the ratio sucked, as mostly men had arrived by the time an event official took to the microphone and said no one would be allowed in or out until it was deemed safe. The reporter peered outside and saw a group of mostly women being held by security. The only thing to do was to continue the party, the official said over the speakers. The music came back on and the men danced somberly to wedding music. Before the dinner, the suite of drab side rooms buried in the basement of the Washington Hilton, Fox News hosted its annual reception. The mood was buoyant, the crowd denser and packed with more Trump administration officials than I've ever seen at this dinner during the Trump era. As I ordered a drink at the bar, Stephen Millard sidled up beside me and ordered a whiskey. His wife, Katie Miller, mingled with Fox hosts nearby. Brendan Carr, tormentor-in-chief of the broadcast networks, made his way around the room, as did Lachlan Murdoch, the CEO of Fox Corporation. It was the beginning of MAGA World's planned night of gentle meshing with the movement's daytime antagonists, where everybody would tip back a glass of Champers to mark the truce. That celebrity mood was soon replaced by fear, which faded just as quickly into a strange sense of normalcy as Washington returned to form. Reporters dove into reporting, and the chattering classes returned to chattering in somewhat more hushed tones. People didn't come here to party, MS later. They came here to party MS now, said one defiant guest. The show must go on. Sure, we can't let the bad guys win, but the evening made it clear that Americans no longer process acts of public violence in the same way we used to. Our next headline, King Trump loves King Charles. For decades, the president has chased the royal imprimatur for his properties and even his dating life. Now, as King Charles visits him in his second term, he's taking on kingly airs in pursuit of a historical immortality. This is by Aidan McLaughlin on April 30th. When Prince Charles visited the United States in 1981, New York Magazine reported that aides to the royal family met with Donald Trump to discuss the purchase of a $5 million apartment in his new building, Trump Tower. A palace spokesperson briskly shot down the report, calling it completely untrue. No matter, stories suggesting royal interest in Trump's properties cropped up frequently during the 1980s and 1990s, generating a lot of publicity for the young developer and his new skyscraper in Manhattan, even as the palace denied them every time. When Trump was asked about the reports, he couldn't help but revel in the implication. A decade after the New York Magazine story, the New York Post published another rumor, one it confessed was maybe started by the Trump Organization, that Princess Diana was looking to buy an apartment in Trump Tower. That's true, Trump said when asked about the story in an interview, and then he mused about dating the princess. She is really hot. She's gained 20 to 25 pounds. She looks great. There could be a love interest. I'd become King of England. King of England. Diana never bought an apartment in Trump Tower, and despite his reported efforts behind the scenes to lure her to one of his parties, Trump never became King of England. He did become president, and his infatuation with the royals has revived their relevance in global diplomacy. This week, in close coordination with 10 Downing Street, King Charles III visited Trump in Washington for several days of pageantry that included a tour of the White House beehive, an address before Congress, and a state dinner during which gifts were exchanged and jokes cracked about the 250th anniversary of American independence from Great Britain. There are hopes that the visit will soothe tensions between the two countries. Given Trump's infatuation with the crown and personal admiration for the current king, the old empire might have a fighting chance. Even after Charles delivered an address to Congress that implicitly refuted some core tenets of Trumpism, there was an ode to limits on executive power, a defense of NATO and Ukraine, a rousing call to protect the natural world. Trump raved about it ahead of the state dinner that night. He made a great speech, the president said. I was very jealous. While I watched from the mezzanine as the king spoke before Congress, commending the United States for its system of checks and balances, the White House posted a photo of Trump alongside Charles with the caption, "Two Kings." It's a tale as old as empires. A century before American independence, King Charles II spent nearly a decade in exile after his father was deposed and executed in 1649. He fled to the Isles of Scilly off the coast of Cornwall and eventually to France and the Spanish Netherlands. But England's fragile new republic did not hold. In 1660, Charles returned to England to be restored as king. Trump faced his own banishment to Mar-a-Lago after leaving the White House in disgrace in 2021. Just 4 years later, he would storm back into power, and the pain of exile has shaped much of what he's done this term. As if in a hurry to leave his mark on Washington and the world, Trump has spent the last year working on projects he hopes will outlast his presidency: demolishing the East Wing of the White House to build a giant ballroom, launching a regime change war with Iran, musing about annexing Canada and Greenland as part of an imperialist campaign to drastically expand the borders of the United States. One suspects that he could rename the country after himself. He would. I think he would love to be King Donald the First more than life itself, says Piers Morgan, who has known Trump for years and spoken to him frequently about the royal family. Partly for the aesthetics, partly to hear people have to call him that, but also because I think he finds the constraints of democracy rather limiting. It's all a way of patting his ego after the scar tissue left by the 2020 loss, one Trump confidant tells me. He has a fixation on delivering historic acts, whether starting a foreign war or replacing a Fed chairman because he didn't move monetary policy in the direction Trump approved of. That forces history to carve his name deeper than his predecessors. David Axelrod is fond of pointing out how curious it is for the United States to celebrate its 250th year of independence from a mad king while under the stewardship of a president who wishes to be one. Trump has stretched the limits of executive power further than any president in modern history. Just this week, Trump's administration announced new charges against enemy of the crown, James Comey, the former FBI director whom Trump has pressured his Justice Department to go after. Andrew McCarthy, a Fox News legal analyst, called the prosecution grotesque, absurd, and bogus. But it's the ornamental qualities of the monarchy Trump seems to prize the most. He's festooned the White House in gilded accents that give it the look of an Atlantic City Versailles. He slapped his name on the Kennedy Center and the Institute of Peace. His lieutenants have draped large banners of his face from government buildings across Washington, D.C. As we first reported here a few weeks ago, he's putting his name on U.S. currency. This week, it was reported that he's putting his face on some American passports. Like the Emperor Napoleon, who commissioned the Arc de Triomphe in Paris after his victory at Austerlitz, Trump has proposed the construction of his own 250-foot arch in the Capitol. Napoleon at least had the humility to build the monument with national pride in mind. When a reporter asked our president who or what the arch was for, Trump replied, "Me." He came back determined not just to govern, but to stamp Trump on anything and everything he could think of, the confidant explains. Trump doesn't see Washington as a city to manage the government. He sees it as a media studio to reshape the country in his image. You think it's coincidence that his inner circle resembles a Fox News green room? There's also a monarchy instinct there. Monuments, arcs, highways, airports, and libraries renamed Trump. Even with U.S. currency and passports, he now wants his own image plastered front and center. It is no coincidence, then, that Trump so admires a family that bears all of the trappings of imperial power, with none of the actual force of it. The royal family reigns, it does not rule. Trump, one suspects, would be just as happy as a ceremonial leader, receiving heads of state as his gilded White House and exchanging gifts as the cameras fluttered and reporters shouted questions about new renovations to the Lincoln bathroom. During the King's visit to the White House on Tuesday, the Marine Band performed as Trump and Charles were guided around the South Lawn. Trump bobbed around pleasantly, grinning and patting his thigh to the music. At the state dinner, Charles presented Trump with a gift, a large golden bell bearing Trump's name, which hung from a British submarine called the HMS Trump in 1994. You couldn't have invented a better gift for the current president. Gold, with Trump's name etched in giant letters, implying his own special place in wartime history. Trump beamed with delight. No matter that the war Trump is actually waging in Iran has quickly devolved into a bloody quagmire, killing thousands, costing the United States billions of dollars, and threatening to plunge the global economy into recession, Trump has his wartime bell. The president was gifted another treat this week to flatter his lifelong admiration for the monarchy. The Daily Mail reported at the start of Charles's visit that Trump might be a distant cousin of the king. This wouldn't be entirely surprising. It is believed that millions of Britons have some ancestral connection with the royals. But Trump treasured the news. "Wow, that's nice," he wrote on Truth Social. "I've always wanted to live in Buckingham Palace." This is from the business tab of the politics section. The fight continues. The Onion's Ben Collins is still trying to get his hands on InfoWars. This is by Chris Murphy on April 30th. Thursday, April 30th, was supposed to be a momentous day for Ben Collins and The Onion. After years of trying to acquire InfoWars, the far-right media company founded by Sandy Hook conspiracy theorist Alex Jones, Collins and his satirical paper were finally set to receive court approval to move forward with their takeover of the internet's most noxious URL. Unfortunately for Collins and company, the Texas Court of Appeals had other plans for The Onion, granting another temporary stay to prevent the handover of InfoWars to The Onion. This newly insane, unprecedented legal stalling does nothing but delay our deal with the receiver to take control of InfoWars, Collins wrote on Blue Sky after the court's ruling. We now expect new traps in Alex Jones' amoral war to deny paying the Sandy Hook families, but we're freshly surprised by the U.S. legal system's appetite to put up with it. 2 days before the ruling came out, Collins was cautiously optimistic about the chance for The Onion to finally take control of InfoWars. "Is this the most elaborate bullshit that I've ever had to encounter to get around to something that I thought was just a nice thing to do? Yes, it is," he told Vanity Fair. "If you want to donate to charity and a guy stabbed you in the fucking face, you're like, why is this happening? Here's $5. That's basically what took place here. It is ridiculous, but we are seeing it through. It's nice to be able to provide this bright spot in the world because, good Lord, shit is dark. And to turn a dark thing into a bright thing is very, very nice. So just cross your fingers and knock on wood." It looks like Collins and The Onion might need to knock harder before they can own or even operate Jones's platform. Collins, a former NBC News journalist who became CEO of The Onion in April 2024 after Twilio co-founder and former CEO Jeff Lawson bought it through his firm Global Tetrahedron, has been put through the ringer in his quest for InfoWars. The company was put up for auction in 2024 after family members of those killed in the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shootings sued Jones for defamation and won $1.4 billion in damages, the largest defamation award in history. Jones appealed the verdict. In October, the Supreme Court declined to hear his case. Following the trial, Jones filed for bankruptcy, and a judge ordered all of the assets from InfoWars and its parent company, Free Speech Systems, to be sold in order to help Jones pay immense debts to the Sandy Hook families. That's when Collins first got involved. The Onion offered $1.775 million in cash to purchase InfoWars. The plan was to remove Alex Jones from his bully pulpit while simultaneously revamping it as an arm of The Onion with the help of gun control nonprofit Every Town for Gun Safety and support from the Sandy Hook families. Although Collins' coalition won the bid, it was ultimately rejected in bankruptcy court. Nevertheless, Collins and The Onion continued their fight. Most recently, they attempted to enter a leasing situation with the far-right media company, where for $81,000 a month, they would license the InfoWars.com domain and brand name, as well as any associated intellectual property. After 6 months, they would have the option to renew the deal. But unfortunately for The Onion, a Texas court system has once again prevented the plan from coming to fruition. If and when they do finally get their hands on InfoWars, The Onion won't waste any time revamping it. "We intend on flipping it over right away," said Collins. "We got a bunch of bullshit ready to go. It's really stupid. Everything that we've planned is very, very dumb, so I hope people get excited for that." Days before the ruling, Collins' excitement was palpable. "Frankly, the newspaper is doing so well that we need to give them more space to show that off," he said. Not every media merger and acquisition has to be the worst news you've ever heard in your entire fucking life. Below, he breaks down his still unfinished quest for InfoWars. Vanity Fair asks, the first time The Onion tried to buy InfoWars, you ran into some red tape. What happened? Ben Collins answers, the first time we won that auction, it was 9 days after the 2024 election. There were a lot of people wondering if the courts were going to hold, where the country was going. I think we walked into a burning building. The judge got a little spooked and kicked it down to a lower court, and we've been waiting for some sort of process there for a long time. Can you explain the lease agreement between InfoWars and The Onion? We got in the way. We said we would take over his lease, we would take over the cost of the estate until we can buy it, which we intend to do. So that's how we got into this leasing construct that will hopefully lead us to buying this thing as soon as we possibly can. While we're leasing it, a big cut of merch sales will go to the Sandy Hook families. And then when we buy it, all of that money, all of the purchase price will go to the families. That's the goal. I know the Sandy Hook families have been on board with you and The Onion. What do you think their response is right now? I'm hoping that last week gave them some Schadenfreude or something, that it gave them the ability to see what the point of this is, because Alex Jones revealed himself to be a stupid clown with bad sources. I hope the families can see what this is, which is that we're uniquely able to point out the ridiculous bullshit that has taken over the brains of America's dumbest people and has been weaponized against them. That's what happened with their trial. They've had to deal with constant harassment. They've had to deal with the most horrific stuff, and InfoWars was the tip of the spear on that. And now we get to show off how ridiculous anyone who ever believed this nonsense is. Alex Jones crashed out online after the news dropped. Were you paying attention to his response? If you put you and me and him in the room when he learned that we had gotten it, two of the three of us would have shirts on. I had a shirt on at the time, so you could just do the math on that one. He took his shirt off and started screaming about stuff and saying that we were satanic pedophiles. That's the default button he presses, I think, when he can't find shit. So that's cool. Unfortunately, I have not read any satanic verses, as far as I know. He's had a really rough week handling this. It's in part because this came out of nowhere. He had a plan to get all that stuff back for free, in his head at least, and we subverted that. And now he has to live with the fact that maybe he's not going to escape this. He's going to have to pay these families some money at some point in his life. Jones even posted a fake mugshot of comedian Tim Heidecker, one comedy half of duo of Tim and Eric, whom you've tapped to run InfoWars. We obviously did not anticipate that he didn't know what The Onion was or didn't know what Adult Swim was. When he posted Tim's fake mugshot from his fake music festival with his fake trial, I think it was very revealing. Alex Jones fans, who had obviously seen Tim's show, said, Alex, what are you doing? Where are you getting your information from? This is obviously fake. And guess what? That's usually how he gets his information. He just makes shit up. When did you choose Tim to run InfoWars? I think it was the day that we initially bid on and won InfoWars. He reached out to us. He was like, I can help. Let me help. So a month later or something, I got back to him and I was like, look, we're still chasing this thing. Let's revisit once we're closer. Once we got closer, we realized he actually is the perfect guy for this. He has this YouTube video of him pretending to be Joe Rogan that goes on for 14 hours. He's perfect. He has mimicked the grotesqueries of American life better than anybody in the world, and he's accrued fans across every party line that you can accrue. In my opinion, he's just always been this American comedy icon. I flew to LA maybe a couple months ago, and I was just like, what would it look like? What would you want this to be? The Alex Jones bit obviously is funny, but it has a shelf life because Alex Jones is a one-note guy, so we have to move past that. And there are other things we have to make fun of in society as well that have not been made fun of correctly. So we want to go after, did you see Sergey Brin, the Google co-founder? He's dating a gut microbiome wellness influencer and is now on the right. I read this today in the New York Times, and I was just like, everybody has brain worms. Nobody's covering these people correctly or making fun of them correctly, and we have to try. So we're going to go after every kind of archetype, left, right, up, down, whatever political side of the spectrum you're on that is infecting your Instagram feed. How is The Onion doing subscription-wise, revenue-wise? We are now the fifth or sixth largest newspaper in the United States. It depends on where the Washington Post is in terms of print subscribers, but literally we have 76,000 and we think they have like 80-something. Since we bought The Onion, projected revenue for this year is 3 or 4 times the projected revenue of the year we bought it. We're doing well, and it's partly because we're really reader-supported. People pay to have this thing shipped to their house. A lot of people's kids, it's their first time seeing a newspaper in any capacity. It's also dovetailing nicely with this physical media thing that all the youths are into. They have fucking MP3 players. Alex Jones has already said that he's going to appeal the decision. What do you say to him? We've kind of had enough of him. We are very hopeful that all this will stop on Thursday and we'll replace it with something a lot better. And he's just going to stop. He's just got to stop. We just want him to stop. Our last article of the hour, Melania Trump's look of fear is the first time America has seen her visibly emote. The First Lady has put her feelings on display 3 times recently, at the strange Epstein press conference and in her Jimmy Kimmel attack. We see anger. At the WHCD, we see fear, and it's the most we've ever seen from her. This is by Joy Press on April 28th. After the aborted White House Correspondents' Dinner on Saturday, a usually chummy event ruined by an alleged assassination attempt, one specific image kept floating into my social media feeds: Melania Trump looking terrified. The First Lady is not known for her wide emotional range, as it registers visibly at least. Her facial expressions run the gamut from hauteur to boredom, as exemplified by the "I really don't care, do you?" slogan on the jacket she wore in 2018 to visit migrant children in a Texas detention center. In Amazon's documentary Melania, which followed her over 20 nominally exciting pre-inauguration days in 2025, her face mostly remains frozen in an elegant mask. As I mentioned in my review, even when she lights a candle in St. Patrick's Cathedral for the first anniversary of her beloved mother's death, she appears locked inside herself, woodenly play-acting grief for the cameras. No wonder that moment at the White House Correspondents' Dinner has been replayed so often over the last few days. It felt like, for the first time, we were seeing something that Melania has been hiding from us. I'm sure I'm not the only one who watched the footage over and over, mesmerized by this glimpse of genuine emotion, terror. Sitting on the dais between her husband and pregnant White House correspondent Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt, the First Lady appears to be engrossed in conversation. The evening's entertainer, mentalist Oz Perlman, hovers over them, trying to guess the name Leavitt has chosen for her unborn child. The moment that shots are heard, Melania stops mid-conversation. Her back stiffens, and her usually stoic face is visibly gripped by fear. While Trump looks around placidly, seemingly unaware and unbothered, Melania asks, "What's happened?" as she appears to be the first at her table to dive underneath it. Throughout modern history, the First Ladies have often served as the empathetic, emotive counterpart to their husbands, who tend to remain more manly and stoic. Michelle Obama, Laura Bush, and Hillary Clinton all exuded emotional sensitivity during their stints in the White House, but that has never been Melania's strong suit. Yet the president uncharacteristically acknowledged his wife's emotions at a press conference after the dinner. He said Melania told him that's a bad noise at the sound of shots being fired. Melania was very cognizant, he continued. It was rather traumatic experience for her. Melania unleashed her rage again on Monday morning, excoriating Jimmy Kimmel for doing a parody of the traditional White House Correspondents' Dinner comedy roast on an episode of Jimmy Kimmel Live he had recorded the night before the actual event was foiled. After making an Epstein joke about the president, Kimmel turned his attention to Melania. "Mrs. Trump, you have a glow like an expectant widow," he said, alluding to the president's age. The comedian had no way of knowing that a gunman would disrupt the actual event when he filmed the bit. If we could have witnessed the feelings flickering over Melania's features as she watched the Kimmel clip, the same way we saw her terror for a fleeting second on the dais, maybe we would finally understand her. This brings us to the end of our time together here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith, your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from vanityfair.com. Thank you for listening and have a great week, everybody.